start recording. I'm not going to discuss the homeworks because many of you got them very, you know, fairly correct. They were a fair amount of work. Sorry about that. But I will be happy to discuss any of them with people afterwards. Durfee? Olidar, I saw. All right, so I'm going to go straight ahead with the buildup of identity by descent in a, in a finite population that's just random mating with no other evolutionary forces. We were considering that case of haploids, and then we're going to convert that easily into the case of diploids. And then I'm going to relate this whole process of inbreeding in a finite population to the other side of the coin, which is genetic drift. And they turn out to be, they're not just vaguely related, they are the same thing. Let me just check that. Yeah. Okay. So we had haploids, in the easiest case, we're following a gene, the locus in the genome. There are N of these individuals, capital N, and we're going forward a generation. And we have this model called the Wright-Fisher model. And you may say, well, this isn't completely realistic as a description of real organisms, but what we're going to show is a concept of effective population size, whereby you can take any other kind of life history and figure out what that does to the rate of change of inbreeding or genetic drift and get a concept of effective population size that takes care of all kinds of other variations on life cycles. So in this one, everybody puts very large but equal numbers of gametes into a big iron pot, gamete pool, and then for the next, those individuals, it's like a juvenile stage where everybody is trying to make it in the world, but only N of them chosen at random find a spot where they can live, and everybody else dies. So you end up with a population of the same size. And who is sitting in this spot is one of these at random, equally chosen from each of the parents, equally chosen from all the gametes, and therefore equally a copy of each of the parents. And the next one is also equally chosen. And since each makes a very large contribution to the gamete pool, one of them making it and surviving doesn't change the proportions of them. They still have equal proportions in the pot of gametes. So the next one is, in effect, sampled without worrying about what happened before, independently, with equal probability. So each one of these is descended from each one of those with equal probability, independently. And now what we want to do is take, label these generations, and take a copy, take a couple, a pair of these, any old pair, and call the probability of identity by descent there F, little f, sub t minus 1, t plus 1, and that's the probability of IBD, where IBD is defined relative to your starting generation. But what's going to be easier for us to do is to do H of T plus 1, which is 1 minus that. So it doesn't matter which one we calculate in, it's just that H is easier. We can always go back and forth. It's the probability of non-identity by descent. And now, we just have to calculate what the H will be between a random pair in terms of what the same quantity would be the generation earlier. This is HT sub T plus 1. Let me write it more clearly. H sub T plus 1. This is H sub T. So now we just have to say, okay, what's the probability of identity by descent of this, those two there? Where, for that, you have to ask where they came from. And there are two cases. One case is where they came from different copies in the preceding generation. And the other case is where they came from the same copy. Doesn't matter if they come from different copies, which pair it is, because they're all, they all have the same probability of identity or non-identity by descent. What is the probability if this one comes from somewhere, and now we're asking where this one came from, what is the probability that it came from the same copy? These are haploids in the preceding generation.
1 over n.
1 over n. Now, some people might think 1 over n squared, but no. We already know that this came from somewhere. Doesn't matter where. Now we say conditional on that. What's the probability if I pick this that I happen to choose it from the exact same copy? This 1 out of n. So it's 1 over n. So h t plus 1 is equal to 1 over n. That's the probability they came from the same copy. Now, what's the probability if they came from the same copy that they are not identical by descent?
H sub t.
That's the probability, well, that's the probability that two separate copies are not identical by descent. I'm saying if they came from two, the same two, the same copy.
Wouldn't it be zero?
It's zero. You have to be identical by, we're not allowing mutation here or anything to disturb the identity by descent. You're coming from the same copy, so you're identical by descent, so you're not non-identical by descent. 1 over n times 0, and the other possibility is that they came from different copies, which is the rest of the probability, 1 minus 1 over n. And if they came from that, they came from different copies in the preceding generation, what's the probability that they're not identical by descent?
1.
No, because this is not the starting generation. This is generation T. The probability, it's not true that all copies in this generation are not identical by descent, that all pairs.
Oh, so it's H sub T.
It's H sub T. So now we have what is a really surpassingly simple formula. Just say, take H sub T and multiply it by 1 minus 1 over n, and you get the H for the next generation, and you keep going. So it follows from that, that in any generation, H is 1 minus 1 over n multiplied t times, if we're in generation t now, times the value it was in the starting generation, which actually is 1, because in the starting generation every pair is not identical by descent. It's the base generation. So probability of non-identity by descent is going down as that happens. Decaying away geometrically. As that happens, 1 minus it will, of course, rise. It's a mirror image. So this is H or F. H is the H is that, and F is that. It will rise towards 1. Okay, 0, 1. This is T for time. You can work out, of course, what the half-life is. Just the same kind of half-life calculation we've been doing. So T sub 0.5 will be the power you have to raise this to make this multiplier 1/2. And I'm not going to go through the steps. It's the same old business if you take logs and you solve. And it becomes 0.693147, but the log of 1/2. Natural log of 1/2 divided by the natural log of 1 minus 1 over n. If n is not too small, you can approximate that by saying the log of 1 minus a little something is approximately minus that little something. I should say this is a minus sign up here. So it's approximately, this becomes minus 1 over n, the minus signs cancel, 693147 over n, roughly. Which means, in a population that's 1,000, n is 1,000, sorry, not 1 over n, what am I doing? Got that wrong. It's times, this is minus 1 over n, the minus signs went away, the 1 over n turns upside down, 0.693147n, so roughly 70.7 of the population size. So the half-life for a population of size 100 is about 69 generations, the half-life for a population size 1,000, 693, the half-life for population size 10,000 is 6,931.47. And so on. So proportional to the populations, a bigger population, it takes longer. But and what's going on is random pedigrees are building up in these populations. And the nice thing is that this complete exchangeability of all this, the symmetry, the exchangeability, allows us to do this simple age calculation, which in correlation form comes from Sewell Wright in the early 1930s. And he could see that, exactly how much inbreeding would build up in a random mating population by a trivial computation. Well, that's for haploids. And you might say, well, now what will we do for diploids? It's going to be more complicated, yada, yada, yada. No, not really. We'll deal with a case where, in fact, we can recycle all this. We'll deal with a case of diploids. Everybody's got two copies. We don't have different sexes or anything. We have n individuals now, okay, which really means 2n copies of the gene. In generation T, we're going forward a generation. Same situation with n individuals. Now, what kind of model do we have here? What we're going to do is imagine these are marine organisms or something. They're casting gametes in the water. And they contribute gametes to a gamete pot equally, and each one contributes a very large number of gametes. So once again, you have a gamete pot. And for each individual, they contribute lots of them, half of which come because of Mendelian segregation, half of them come from the left copy and half come from the right copy. And that's true for everybody. So once again, a gamete pot with the original copies of the gene, forget about the individuals, the copies of the gene make equal contributions to the gamete pot. And once again, we draw copies for the next generation, and we draw them randomly, and getting one of them doesn't really change the proportions in the pot, so when you draw the next one randomly, it has the same probability. So independent draws again. Now notice, so then if you look at it, you'll say, well, you know, it's actually the same thing. It's just that let's not pay attention to these big circles, let's pay attention to the little dots. There are 2n of them. They're each contributing equally. These 2n are drawn from those 2n, independent, identically distributed, in effect with replacement. That is, when once you've drawn one, you haven't changed the probabilities of who comes from which parent. So it's really just like the haploid case. And I can go through the same argument, and I will get that HT plus 1 is equal to 1 minus 1 over what? Well, times the previous age. So the question is, what's under the 1 there?
2n.
Sorry?
2n.
2n. Because there are 2n copies. So it's just like having 2n haploid individuals. Now they're packaged together in pairs and called diploids. So same dynamics, same equation here. T of 0.5 is 2 times, it's minus 693147 over natural log 1 minus 1 over 2n, all approximately the same thing, 693147, times 2n, which is going to be 1 point, I have to get this right, 386294 times n. So again, in that population, it's a diploid population. If there's 1,000 individuals, it's 1,386 generations until half the pairs of copies in the population have built up to having half the ultimate level, 0.5 on average level of identity by descent. Yeah, please, great so moment to
this,
ask.
This assume that each individual can reproduce by themselves.
Well, they're doing as some marine organisms do. They squirt gametes up, and the other one squirt, and then gametes combine and fertilize. Is that reproducing by oneself? I think it's a semantic issue. I mean, now, one of the properties here is, can an individual self-fertilize in this system? It can, yeah. As he nods, so because you squirt gametes up, you're responsible for 1/n of all the gametes. Your two copies are responsible for 1/2n each. When two copies are drawn, it's possible they both came from you. A small fraction of the time they will. So this kind of random mating has the property that individuals can mate with other individuals or with themselves, with a small probability, and nothing stops that. And you might want to say, aha, well, what if that's not possible? We will get to that under the heading of effective population size. It will turn out to have a very small effect on the rate of increase of identity by descent. It's not obvious. You think, well, self-fertilization, that'll be pretty serious. Actually, we'll see not. Then one can take it and go to what happens if you designate half the individuals as, quote, females, and the other half as, quote, males, and now you have two gamete pots. And to produce an offspring, you have to pick a female gamete and a male gamete and put them together. And we'll see that also doesn't make a huge difference, but if the sex ratios are off from a half, it has some effect. That will all be under the heading of effective population size. Because of my running late in the course, I won't be able to really take you through those arguments, but they are in the book, but I'll tell you the results. I thought I saw a hand up. Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm not sure about my question. So you just said this is like a case where there is self-compatibility, but there's a lower probability that yourself, like your gametes, are
so
finding each other.
So you allow some self-fertilization, but less.
Yes. What in those cases when you have self-compatibility, but there's like higher probability that your gametes find your own gametes, like in a flower, because you're...
Yeah, that will have... Now, if it's true that you quite often self-fertilize, that can have a large effect. If you self-fertilize less often than random, that carries you some distance towards not having self-fertilization. But as I mentioned, not having self-fertilization, random self-fertilization, doesn't actually have a very big effect, so it isn't going to make a large effect. But they're, worth worrying about if you're a plant person, particularly if you are a plant person. Well, she's actually an animal, but studies plants. Okay, now, that's the quick calculation. What I want to do is try to relate this before we go on to effective population size. To genetic drift, and I want to do it by running our simulation program, which is a program that developed from a Fortran program I wrote in the 1970s, a mere 40 years ago, when I was teaching elementary biology. It was then called Biology 210, the equivalent of Biology 180 today. I wanted to do a computer program to have the students run a computer program that would show genetic drift in progress. And we had to have them punched. They were using punched cards, and they were going down to the computer center, which was two blocks. It's a concrete building over on Brooklyn and Pacific. It's still there, but it's not the computer center anymore. And students went in and submitted their jobs and got printouts back and so on. Over the years, it mutated. It graduated to different languages and became something you could run interactively and finally something you could run on your own machine. So we have that set up. Let's see. In the back, I have gone through these. I'm going to lower the, turn off the lights momentarily. I think we've been through all this stuff. We went through, I think we're coming to the, oh, I've got the wrong one. Okay. I think what I'm going to do is show it next time, but I'll do the simulation this time. Could somebody push the escape key, which is in the upper left there? Yeah, thank you. Then, with a little maneuvering, this is a mouse. With a little luck, yeah, I can dismiss, if my eyesight is sharp enough, I can dismiss these. Are we in the popj.jar? Is that, is one of these that?
No, they're all PDFs.
They're what?
All PDFs.
There it is. I double-clicked on it, and this is in a Mac. It works a little differently on Windows. You can take the window. What comes up is a plot. Now, this program you will run for your next homework. And I also urge you, you can download it from the website. It's a Java executable, a Java jar file. If Java is installed on your machine, if you have a Mac, Java is installed. If you have Windows, it is easily installable from a link which is given in the documentation to this program from java.com. If you have a, for example, Linux system, you should have a Java which should be able to run it. If you have, however, a tablet with either iOS or Android, you are out of luck. They don't quite run these Java things, and there's things you have to mess around. It becomes a mess. If anybody knows a way to make a generic Java file that will run on those, let me know. But I don't know how. Without creating a specialized version just for that, each of those operating systems, which is more pain than I'm willing to do. The way you run this, it's a program which allows you to simulate a bunch of populations which may or may not exchange migrants. You get control over that. You're seeing a plot of horizontally are generations and vertically are a gene frequency at a single locus from 0 to 1. Up here there is a file menu and a run menu. I think it says run. I can't see it from here. New run, if you choose new run, you get a box that will, I guess it's not getting bigger, that will show you all the parameters of the run. Now, I'm so far away, I literally can't see them. My eyesight's pretty good, but not that good. Okay, what it has there is, in this box, the number of individuals in the population. What I'm going to do, I can't type anything, so I'm going to, from here, so I'm going to just leave it that way. It has three fitnesses of the three genotypes. There's two alleles, the usual three genotypes. They're all 1.0. It has a mutation rate in one direction and a mutation rate in the other. They're both set to zero. It has a migration rate between populations. It's an island model with symmetrical exchange among all populations, but it's at rate zero now. The initial frequency is given as 0.5. What I'm going to do for to make it a better teaching example is put my cursor there and see if, can you hit backspace and see if it works? Can you type 4? So we're going to start at 0.4. Actually, let me start up here. Can you type 0, please? We're going to make 1,000 individuals, not 100. down here, generations to run. I'm going to run 1,000 generations. And number of populations, I'm going to leave at 10. And then there's something about random numbers, which you mostly don't, unless you're going to play games with it in very elaborate ways, I wouldn't bother with that. Now what we do is we can start a run. Now remember, this is a population of 1,000 individuals. It is simply reproducing, no selection, no migration, no mutation, but finite population size, random mating. So it follows this diploid model up that I just gave you. And remember that the time to lose half of the non-identity by descent or gain half of the identity by descent is 1,386 generations. Here we're only running 1,000. Okay. Now what you'll see is it will plot. I'm going to click now. And there it goes. This is 10 different populations. They're jiggling around. The jiggling is genetic drift. And I'm going to discuss that in just a second. They're doing so independently. These populations are unconnected with each other. They all started from the same gene frequency. The blue line here is what would happen in an infinitely large population with no genetic drift. And what happens is, Hardy-Weinberg, the frequency doesn't change. That's the result of the Hardy-Weinberg proportions, the Hardy-Weinberg law. But the individual populations, in finite populations, the gene frequencies jiggle and go up and down. Now if you go to run menu, you can either continue with 1,000 generations or just continue, in which case it asks you how many generations, or do a new run or restart, which restart will just restart with the same parameters, or something underneath it I can't even see. Change.
Oh, whole plot.
Well, I'll show you a whole plot in a minute. So I'm going to continue with 1,000. So there we are with 10 populations at the end here. They're spread out around the expectation. Up here it says fixed zero, and down here it says lost zero. So nobody has gotten fixed or lost. I'm going to continue. Click. There it goes. Now what you'll see is one population went down to zero and stayed there forever. The others have continued, so we keep going. Another 1,000. Now, one population went up to one. I think I see another one did, and another one almost did, but didn't quite. Should say, I can't see it, but it say two there?
Yeah.
And it should say one down here. And you keep going, and you'll see that gradually more and more populations will go up to one or down to zero, will fix or get lost for gene frequency, until finally, there's only two of them that are not. We'll hear one of them that's not, and then we watch it and watch it. And finally, it gets lost. Now, how many are fixed?
Four
fixed and six not. Six lost, which is exactly what you expect. So, what's happening there? Let me give you the sort of more intuitive feel for what genetic drift is doing, and then we'll try to relate it to this process of buildup of identity by descent, buildup of inbreeding. In a population, imagine that the front of the room is a gene frequency scale with 0 over there and 1 over there. And I'm standing at 0.4. And we're producing a new generation. And what's going to happen is each copy in the new generation is a random draw from copies in the preceding generation with a probability of what as being big A. Now we're following the gene frequency, not the identity by descent. If I'm a copy in the next generation, I was drawn at random from one of the copies in this generation where the gene frequency is 0.4. What is the probability that that copy turned out to be a big A? Can I hear you?
0.4.
0.4.
0.4,
it is. Now when I draw another one, also 0.4, is it independent?
Yes.
The answer was, well, yes, they're independent draws from the copies of the preceding generation. So what we have is 2n copies, each of which is like a coin toss with a heads probability of 0.4, and they're independent. So it's a binomial distribution, which is what you get with coin tosses. And each generation, you've tossed a coin with the probability 0.4 of heads, you've done it 2n times, you don't exactly get 0.4, sometimes you do. You'll get a few more, a few less. With very small chance that you'll get a lot more or a lot less. So the gene frequency will change a little. So it'll move a little. Might move this way, might move that. On average, it doesn't move. But in individual cases, it's moving. And so it's what's called the drunkard's walk. It's like I'm walking down the corridor here, gene frequency 0 and 1 on both sides, and I'm inebriated. And as I go forward, I step sideways a little bit as I walk down the corridor. A sticky paint is painted on the wall. It's not dry yet. And you get this drunkard's walk occurring. Technically, in mathematics, it's a random walk. And if I happen to get far enough over that I hit the wall, I'm stuck to the paint. Why? Because I've lost the other allele. There is no way to get back out into that scale. So then, with time is going this way, you just slide along the paint. So we can imagine a group of drunkards here, and they each is a population, and each is doing this. Stick to this wall. Stick to that wall. They all start out here, they spread out, they end up stuck to the 0 and 1 walls. You saw that happen in the simulation. By the way, I've been doing the drunkard's walk. People get very excited when a teacher does that. I've been doing this and the mating dance of Drosophila, which I won't do for you, since I taught elementary biology 40 years ago. And some students who saw that have gone on to do it. You can go on the web, and I think it's Andrew Hendry at McGill University does it, credits it to me. He does it with a bottle of whiskey in hand. Canadians are harder drinkers than Americans. And he actually staggers back and forth with a real bottle, and he takes slugs from it as he goes. Okay. So you saw it happening on the simulation. You can do it yourself. I really urge you to play with the simulation just to get a feel. What will natural selection do? How much selection do you need to go against mutation? Is that how does it get a result similar to the formulas that we've seen? And so on. And now the question arises whether we can think of the spread of populations. By the way, if this were not a floor, but if it were a balance beam and pivoted right where I'm standing, if I step to the left, it'll tip, the balance beam will tip. If I step to the right, it'll tip. But if I have a whole bunch of drunkards, and some step to the left and some step to the right, on average, their center of mass will stay the same if I have enough populations. And ultimately, the probability of fixation and loss will be such that the balance beam stays the same. Because at each point, they're on average not going sideways. They're going sideways randomly one way or the other, but the average is still not to change. So you can figure out from that what the fixation probability is, and it turns out to be the same as the starting gene frequency. We saw it happen to work out perfectly in 10 replicates here, which is unusual, but there was a 40% chance of fixing and a 60% chance of loss. Normally, you really only see that if you have lots of replicates. There is a good reason for that in terms of identity by descent. I want to relate it back to identity by descent. As these copies, as identity by descent builds up, what's happening is as it gets up near 1, you're getting to a situation where all the copies are identical by descent, which means they all came from one lucky copy in the original generation. That some copies are reproducing more than others as a result of randomness of birth, randomness of death, and randomness of Mendelian segregation. And so some copies will have more offspring, other copies less offspring. Oh, and then their descendants may have more or less offspring and so on. And finally, one lucky copy just accidentally wins the jackpot and is the progenitor of the entire, at that locus, of the entire population. And if you think of it in terms of gene frequencies, well, whatever gene it had, whatever allele it had, has now gotten up to 100%. But it's just one of the initial copies chosen at random. So what's the probability that once you get to fixation, it turns out to be for a big A as opposed to a little a? What's the probability of big A wins? It's the probability that that initial copy happened to be a big A. Remember, their reproduction got nothing to do with, there's no selection, so their reproduction has got nothing to do with whether the big A or little A. It's random. So it's the probability, it's the initial gene frequency, is the probability that an allele takes over. If there were 12 alleles, it works the same way. The initial frequencies of each of the 12 is the probability that those alleles are the one, that that allele is the one that wins. And that's simply because you're randomly sampling descendants of a single initial randomly chosen copy. Of course, you put in selection, they're not chosen at random. Then there's bias, there's biases and things change it. You can run the simulation and find out for yourself. So I want to finish off by talking about the spread of gene frequencies and giving you, by a quick hand wave without doing all the steps, a simple calculation that says, that gives you a feel. So you can see first of all that the buildup of identity by descent is simply the same process as genetic drift. It's not a different thing. So Sewell Wright, by doing this calculation, got a quick, good feel for what the time dynamics of genetic drift was in the early 1930s. It was really a great achievement. And he also invented the concept of effective population size a few years later. But now, let me just talk about the spread of gene frequencies. Let me do it here. So what we're going to do is take different populations. Now, these are not individuals anymore. I'm going to make them a little oval, so where they aren't individuals. And we're going to have number them, and there's a lot of them. They're different populations, and they're independently genetically drifting. We're not going to have any connection between them. And they will drift, and after T generations, they'll have some gene frequency. And I'll call those P0, P1, P2, all the way up to P1 million. So genetic drift has been going on independently. Now, if I... we're going to sort of play back and forth between three quantities here. One is, I can ask, first of all, if I have lots of these replicates, about the average of these P's, the average gene frequency over many, many replicates of genetic drift. What do you think it is? The average probability. Well, you saw it up there. It was the blue line. It was, which is now, well, it is there. I think I can see. Although individual populations are going up or down, the average of them varies much less. There's a simulation, a plot in the text in chapter 6 on this point which shows you the average for 10 replicates, and it does wander up and down some, but much less than the individual populations. If I've got like a million populations, basically, it won't change, and so the average of these is going to be the same as the initial gene frequency. We're assuming that all populations started with the same frequency, we'll call it P sub zero. So the average doesn't change. But what about the variance among the populations? Well, that's where, see if I can do this and do it quickly. The variance of these P things, well, the one formula for variances is it's the average of P squared minus the average of P, of the P's, quantity squared. It's the mean of the squares minus the square of the means. That's a formula for variance. Now, if we take the average of P squared, one thing that is the average, it's P squared, P1 squared, for example, is the expected frequency of homozygotes, big A, at that generation in that population. This P2 squared is the expected frequency of big A's in that population, and so on. So I claim that is this thing here is the probability of big A averaged over the population. This is the average of the P's. It's P0 squared. Okay. Now there is a there's Sewell Wright's formulas that I showed you when we were talking about inbreeding, that the probability of a homozygote, it is P squared times 1 minus F plus P times F. That was the formula I gave you. F is the identity by descent. You can rewrite that as P squared plus P minus P squared, which turns out to be P times 1 minus P times F. It's just a little algebraic rearrangement. The variance, if this is averaged in a pedigree, it's sort of averaged over all outcomes, or you can think of it in this, the pedigrees of the individual populations, it's also true. The probability of big A minus P squared will be equal to P times 1 minus P times F. Now, what's F? F is the probability of identity by descent. If you go out to generation T, F will be 1 minus that probability of non-identity by descent, which is 1 minus 1 over 2n t times. So you start with the probability of identity by descent 0, non-identity by descent is 1. You go forward t generations, the probability of non-identity by descent is this thing to the t power. You want to get the probability of identity by descent, so you subtract from 1. Put it in this formula, and then the variance of gene frequencies is just that. It's P times 1 minus P times this thing. And this thing in boxes is just the dotted line here going up towards 1. So the variance of gene frequencies goes from 0 up to a limit, which is P times 1 minus P. And it goes up just proportional to the probability of identity by descent. So as inbreeding builds up in the population, the populations become, the individual copies in the population become more similar to each other, more identical. Between populations, the gene frequencies become more different. In effect, genetic drift here is converting the within-population variation into between-population variation. And finally, just to finish off, What about this mysterious number p times 1 minus p? That turns out to be the variance when you've got a fraction p of the population's fixed for big A and a fraction 1 minus p fixed for little a, which is exactly what we expect to end up with. So it's simply the variance among of gene frequency among populations when you get out to fixation. So what I've done is, aside from introducing you to the program, PopG, which I again urge you to start using. I'll assign an assignment, I hope, later today or tomorrow. Told you about the buildup of inbreeding coefficients of probability of identity by descent in populations, how quickly it occurred. Told you about genetic drift. Hinted about effective population size. Told you about how genetic drift is the same is the other side of the coin of inbreeding in a population, and giving you the formulas by this sort of indirect probability of homozygotes argument for how much the variance is expected to spread out among different populations that are independently genetically drifting. Okay. So if there's anybody else who came in and didn't get their homeworks, see me. I turned the homeworks back. And we'll go forward. Next time, we're going to talk more about effective population size. And I'm going to have to give you rapid fire a lot of results, because then we want to go on and ultimately talk about coalescence, which is an interesting connection with all this.